Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Stephanie Sorrell, who is the author of Depression, Understanding the Black Dog. Stephanie was born in London and lived most of her life in the United Kingdom, and basically has been writing spiritually based texts for some time. She was offered editorship for a spiritually oriented publishing trust in her mid-30s, and later on got her MA in psychosynthesis psychology at the London Institute for Psychosynthesis, and has been exploring the relationship between depression and spirituality for some time now. Welcome, Stephanie. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Susan.
So, would you like to tell our listening audience a little bit more about yourself and how you came to study this subject of depression in spirituality?
I emerged from a family that had taken a number of my members, my uncle and my my father, and that sort of, and I realized that later on, when I was about 16 or 17, I had inherited depression.
Mm-hmm.
But it took me a long time to accept it. And at some point, yes, in my 30s, I decided to study in psychosynthesis psychology in London. And I did it over 3 or 4 years because I was running the Science of Thought Publishing Trust as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, and I did the training over, yes, 6 years. But in that time, I was in hospital myself for a little while. So I really could relate to people that suffer from depression.
Well, I think most of us have had some experience with depression, but the majority of people probably only experience, I guess, what you would call situational depression, you know, reactive depression. And that is, you know, when they lose a significant relationship or a family member or something, a job doesn't go well, but there's some cause of it. And that is, to varying degrees, it can be mild, it can be moderate, occasionally it can be severe, but in general, in my experience as a physician, severe depression usually has a familial or, I guess, a family history or at least a recurring theme. If people tend to be severely depressed, they will meet this at several times throughout their life. Do you think that that's probably
accurate? Yes, that's true. That's true, and it can be cyclical. It can manifest in the fall or in the spring. Changes within seasons, really, apart and also, you know, traumas in life and stepping stones to new parts of your life.
So, you know, I think it's real important to differentiate between someone who just seems to be lost without purpose, you know, going through a phase, sad because of certain things that have happened and difficulty in handling those. That's a very different situation than someone who becomes severely depressed. And your book does a good job of describing it. I did want to tell you that I was several years ago supposed to interview, I think it's Andrew Solomon on his book.
Oh, yes, The New Demon.
But he had to, and so I read that book, and I thought it was a fabulous description of depression. This person has truly captured what it is on a day-to-day basis to go through something like this. But unfortunately, he was too depressed to do the interview, which was, that can happen, right. But he didn't have the connection with spirituality that you have. I mean, he didn't make that connection at all. And so that's why I was really interested in interviewing you, because I had always felt that, you know, that there were significant, things to understand about depression through spirituality, especially about the connection of where we get our energy. You know, I mean, you talk about these spiritual experiences in your book that I think we've all experienced, where we get this burst of energy and enlightenment because we see something. You said you saw this big, gigantic flock of birds overhead, and that triggered something.
Yeah.
So most of us can, at least a couple of times in our lives, have something like that that really causes a flood of energy in that is awe-inspiring and whatever. But given that that connection exists, and it probably comes from our soul, you know, where we're given an inspiration or an energy burst at a certain time, it would be reasonable to assume that if that energy that is ongoing from our soul to our personality is cut off for some reason, then you could plunge into a really, really, really deep depression. In other words, the energy that we have might not just be located within the third dimension.
No, that's true. I would agree with that. I think I had an experience where, because I feel that joy and depression hang very closely together. It sounds a bit strange, but especially in bipolar disorder, where you can go down. I mean, there are two types of bipolar disorder, bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. Bipolar 1 is less severe, and bipolar 2 is... bipolar 2 is less severe, sorry. And bipolar 1 is more extreme. And I know when I was in absolute darkness for a long time, many months, in fact, 5 or 6 months, I just one day felt a great joy in me, which seems like a paradox, really. And I had this experience where I was sitting up in bed, and I wasn't sleeping at all, which is one of the things that goes with depression. And I saw this figure at the end of my bed, cloaked in, wearing a black cloak. And I remember mentally asking why he or it, I didn't know, it was just a being, was so dark. And he drew apart his cloak, and there was this incredible shining light there, and his darkness was holding the light there. And I've never really forgotten that, how joy can run so closely with depression.
Well, one explanation would be that the third dimension has a quality that presumably the other dimensions don't have, and that's that of polarity. And so we come to the third dimension to experience the polar opposites, good and bad, you know, evil and well, love and fear, you know, and light and darkness. We're always trying to balance our male and female aspects. You know, everything, Buddha says everything is finding the middle road, you know, but we... To find the middle road, we have experienced the two ends of things. And I always thought that bipolar, which I have a number of patients who have bipolar illness, and I really do appreciate what they go through with this, because that is generally inherited, and it generally, you need to anticipate it, because it can get so extreme. And without diagnosis, it can be deadly. I mean, your book, we don't, when you really understand the percentage of people that with bipolar illness, especially the severe, if it goes untreated, the percent that will kill themselves it is similar to cancer and severe heart disease. So that's where it comes out being an emergency to recognize and to get people into treatment. And so, you know, you talk in your book about people who don't really appreciate this, expecting people with bipolar disease to, you know, pick themselves up by their bootstraps and, you know, get on with it and get their lives in order and everything. All very nice things to say, but you point out that people with bipolar disorder that's really severe can't even begin to do that. You know, it's just impossible, which I think is an important note for people. So if you see a friend, you know, you talk about friends. If you see your friend going through this, don't hesitate to get them medical help. You know, don't hesitate.
No, that's very important.
Force them, drive them to the doctor, or get a psychiatrist involved if the doctor isn't doing what they need to do, which is get them on medication.
Yeah, that's a very important medication, a very important part of the journey. And I say that very strongly because I fought medication for many years. I thought that I was taking the shortcut if I took medication. And also it takes a long time, sometimes, well, it can take up to 6 weeks to get into the system. And any medicine, you can feel, like homeopathy, you can feel worse before you get better. And the thing is, with medication, it's something I feel strongly about, actually. You can't get any benefit from therapy if you're too depressed and slowed down to form a simple sentence. And that's the difference between mild depression, really. In moderate and major depression, everything slows down. Thought, speech, even movement. It's literally like driving with the brakes on. Most people, especially in the UK and men in general, feel ambivalent about the use of antidepressants and mood stabilizers because they feel they are losing their autonomy or taking medications is a cop-out. And this is a complete myth because, you know as a doctor that if you don't take your cardiac medications, you're going to hit the wall. Or if you have arthritis, you know, you need to take anti-inflammatories or you can't, you know, it's difficult to move. And if you stop taking insulin for diabetes or anticonvulsants for epilepsy, why on earth are antidepressants any different? You die.
No, they're not. They're not. Yeah. So, you know, if anybody out there who's listening sees a significant change in behavior and thought process in a friend or family member where they are not sleeping, unable to eat, or a major change in eating, sleeping, being able to get out of bed to, you know, just do get themselves a shower and, you know, just staying in the bed all day. These are signs of depression, and depression can be deadly. Now, you pointed out in your book, and it's really true, that when you're in the throes of depression, you don't have enough energy to kill yourself. So that's not when you kill yourself. That's not
when you
attempt suicide. Yeah.
Yeah, it's when you're actually getting better.
Right.
That can be quite a dangerous period because you're getting better, and so you're beginning to think. That's why it's a dodgy area, getting medication enough into your system, because some people just stop taking medication when they feel better and it hasn't really worked its way in enough.
So how long does it take for the average SSRI inhibitor to stabilize someone with bipolar disease? What would you say?
Well, for some people, I mean, it does vary. It can take about 3 or 4 weeks. But from my point of view, my experience rather, it took about 6 or 7 weeks, which is very
long,
actually.
That's a long time. Yeah, that's a long time. It really is,
And, you know, it's a hazardous place to be in that in-between space, too.
Yeah, it really is. And you talk about, you know, people, friends and family putting, doing suicide watch. I think you mentioned Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln, and how Abraham Lincoln had, of course, they didn't have medication back then, so that his friends went on suicide watch with him before he became president.
That's right. And he had some very good friends, and I'm very glad that he had good friends because we wouldn't have had a president otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. And you also talk about how certain personality traits, especially leaders during war, and you used Lincoln and Churchill as examples, how their personality and psychological profiles having been, I guess, shaped by having cyclical depressions, really benefited them to shine during times of war. It was fascinating.
Yeah, because you dug down deep. You can use that in, I mean, not just depression, but in other illnesses that really, you know, that are really difficult to come to terms with and work with. Mm. You're able to reach the ground level as well as the more idealistic, you know, higher level of consciousness.
Right, right. And, you know, do you want to tell the listening audience why they call depression the black dog and when that phrase came into being?
I think it came into being before Winston Churchill. And it's Churchill took it up, and I suppose he made it his own. He said a dog is something that follows you around all the time, and that's where it came from. But I think it went back even earlier than that. I don't have a photographic memory, so I can't.
It has to do with that it's with you. You know, it follows you and it can pounce at any time and you know, manifest
itself.
Yeah,
it's a shadow, really, and it's sort of, you do feel hounded because a dog follows you everywhere. So you do actually feel that it's, even if you've come through, that it could come again, and it might not come again. And that's the thing about depression. Nothing is really cut and dried. You don't need to believe that you're going to have this forever. Because when I took medication, I've sort of had about 4 or 5 years where I felt reasonably stable. I have dips, which is miraculous, really. And I took homeopathic medicine and all sorts of other things, and it didn't really address the level of depression that was there.
Right. Yeah, that's very true. So lately, you know, we've had some famous people commit suicide, Robin Williams, and then the actor that was in the the series, and I don't know what they're going to do for the third one because he was a very important part of the.
Oh yes, yeah.
It hasn't come out yet. Mockingjay hasn't come out yet.
I mean, Robin Williams, I was absolutely gutted about that because he actually embodied the roles he played, because sometimes you get actors that just, you know, are the same through each part they play. They just have different words.
Right.
But he could really embody it, what he was, the character.
But there was a great deal of evidence that he was manic. I mean, His act on stage was manic, and he didn't seem to drop it when he was not on stage. You know, So, and do you think he probably was bipolar? I mean, it sounds like he might.
I think he probably was. He sounds like it, and I can only just say that from the things that I've read about him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, bipolar people are very, very talented. I've got a couple of musician friends that are musicians, and they can't actually do normal jobs because, you know, it's hard to stabilize. I mean, even on lithium, it's hard to become stabilized. And they sometimes go into hospital and come out, but they're incredibly talented.
So there does seem to be a relationship between creativity and depression.
Yeah, there is. My uncle was very creative, and he was, you know, he was larger than life, really, and had a terrific sense of humor and could get everyone laughing. But he was bipolar, and he committed suicide when I was about seven. So that had a real impact on me. I remember this policeman coming into the garden. It was summer in England, which can be quite idyllic, and was in the 1950s. And I was just aware of this policewoman, and then I was told to go away and play. And I remember my granddad just crying and howling. And and the thing that really got to me was he had asked me before he left whether I loved him, because he used to come and visit. He went to Africa backwards and forwards, and I think also because he worked out there, because of the light, he felt better in Africa. And he asked me whether I loved him, and I said I did, and that was before he left, and I'm so glad I said that. And he said, you don't just love me for the pocket money I give you. And I said, no, I love you for you. And it was so important, that.
Well, people who are severely depressed, they feel unloved. I mean, they feel separated. They feel, even from their families, they don't feel connected. And you talk about this in your book very early on, that the sense of connection is gone with life.
Yeah, that's true. You can't reach out. You want to reach out. People say, well, why don't you ask for help, or why didn't you contact me? Mm-hmm. But you just can't. It's the polar opposite of being sociable, really.
Right.
And I think a lot of this depression is very endemic in our society, which is about the pressure to be more, to have more, which always leaves us with a sense of not having enough. And also having these high ideals which can emerge from this pressure. And generally, because of these ideals and living very much on the surface level of the world, there's this lack of purpose, meaning, and value, which is so important to everyone, really, to feel connected to a sense of purpose and or a spiritual anchor of some kind. I think, I mean, people ask me whether depression is increasing, and on one level, the population is growing, but I think the transparency in emotional feelings and the lives of the rich and famous being up for all to see, and the need for the developing world to have what we have, there's an arrow of comparison which is very powerful and keeps us feeling that we're not good enough. That's very strong.
Well, you know, you understand that that life is very different now than it was when we were growing up. We had much more promise and much more. I mean, the 60s were incredibly economically forward, and we went to the moon, and there was all these things that were happening that were so exciting and so different. And then, you know, you hit the various depressions and recessions, or, you know, they were called recessions, but they were definitely where energy slowed down, not just economically, but in creativity and everything else. And the, you know, the, I think the opportunities that young people have just dissolve when we're in one of these long recessions, like after 2008.
Yeah,
you know, even if you can scrape together the money to go to college, you know, when you get done, what are your job? You know, there's only certain areas that you can even get jobs in. So that would be what I would call kind of a situational, I guess, opportunity for depression, because your friends aren't getting jobs, you're not getting jobs. You have to move back in with mom and dad, which is a bummer when you're 22, you know, or 24.
And it's not what you plan to do, really.
Exactly, yeah. So you don't feel good about yourself.
No.
But that, you know, and that's a situational. Now, there is a danger, and I'm sure you've seen this. I treat women who are sick, toxic, really, within a lot of co-infections from their breast implants, chemical toxicity from silicone and biotoxicity from mold around saline and silicone implants. They have sick building syndrome. They have fibromyalgia. They have chronic fatigue.
Yeah.
So they go in and they have like 30 symptoms, but their labs are normal. Their regular labs are normal. So their doctor says, well, you're depressed. And they all are put on SSRI inhibitors, and I mean every single one of them, just about, as well as Xanax. Now Xanax can help them because they actually have a GABA deficiency. That's something that does occur, so they feel better on Xanax. But unfortunately, it's fairly addictive, so you know that's a problem. But they end up on SSRI inhibitors, and it really isn't helping them because they don't have a serotonin deficiency, and it can actually hurt them because it does have some potential problems with interfering with detoxification, which is what they really need. So so basically what I see is massive abuse of putting people on drugs that they don't need, and then that leads to a bunch of opinions about it, and then when somebody really needs it, their friends and families may not recognize it because other friends and family were put on and didn't do anything except maybe make them worse. You see the problem?
Yeah.
It's like giving antibiotics for viral infections, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it's the medical profession wanting to give a prescription every time a patient walks in. Wanting to do it in 5 minutes rather than taking the time to really diagnose what they have. And, the Xanax and the SSRI inhibitors are, at least in America. Now, that may not be true in England because of the differences in our system. But here, the doctors just want something quick and easy and get the patient out the door, especially when they don't know what's going on. And unfortunately, with fibromyalgia and other things, they don't know. I mean, they really don't understand what's going on. They don't. You know, they've been told that silicone doesn't cause any problems, and half of them believe it because they don't do any research into their literature.
That has happened a few times in this country as well, where
the PIPs, So basically, I guess, what we're trying to emphasize and your book emphasizes that when somebody has a true depression or has symptoms of bipolar disease, which is the alternating mania or, going faster than you should with periods where going way slower than you should, that really is a call for help and needs to be treated. Now, in terms of taking, there's a big difference in how men and women react to untreated depression in terms of suicide risk. Tell me if you agree with this, but I think men take more violent steps, shooting themselves or jumping off buildings. You know, there's no return from that, whereas women tend to take pills, and there's often a return from that because somebody will find them, somebody will go over to their house or whatever. In other words, if they're not supposed to die, somebody can intervene, whereas if somebody jumps off a building, there's very little chance to intervene.
That's true. It's I think there's so much shame along, you know, for males, because, you know, they're fed on images really from childhood that they, you know, that they need to be strong and, you know, they have plastic guns and, you know, I think also in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, all through that, and even now, fathers can't always recognize that their sons might be depressed. And if they do, they're afraid that they, that, you know, they will become depressed. So they try to deter them from going that way and try to boost them up with physical games and things.
So,
I just think the male population are fed with these images through the media of strong and warrior-like images, and also learn how not to show their feelings from their fathers.
Right.
And it's seen as mental sickness, really, weakness.
And in England, it's probably worse because of the stiff upper lip, you know, mentality that the men are taught. Probably not so much the women, but the men definitely.
Yeah, and thank God for Andrew Solomon and Peter Cramer and William Styron. You know, I think Andrew Solomon's done so much for the male population or any population. I mean, I just found his book, The Noonday Demon. You know, it's a fantastic book.
He's not just writing
about it. He's talking about his own experience, his own battle with depression.
If anybody thinks that depression is not super serious and has a misunderstanding about it, just read The Noonday Demon. I mean, it will set you straight on what depression is about. It's an interesting journey. And you know, it is true that the cyclical nature of it, I've had friends who have depression, and the cyclical nature of it always is just hanging over them. You know, that's the problem.
That's it. And you learn after a while to not put yourself under too much stress, which is
pretty
hard in this world. I went into several nursing careers, and I had to give them up because I just became ill. So I'm sort of very. I work as a clinical support worker, and I can see that depression, you know, it's underneath a lot of the illnesses there. A lot of people are depressed, and I think that's why particularly men self-medicate, but women do too, but behind closed doors.
Right. Yeah, I have a friend who had to drop out of medical school, I think in the second year or third year, because of depression. So that's like emphasizing what you just said.
Yeah.
You know, your career path can be disrupted. It really is, because... You know, it's like, and I think what I really want to say here is that even with treatment, depression doesn't always leave you with enough energy to, say, become a doctor, a nurse, you know, or any other major time when you really have to, like, for 4 years be on track, you know.
Even
medicated. I mean, medication definitely has a good effect in people not killing themselves. I mean, that's known. But it's not always good enough. And you go into the reasons in your book very well, the tolerance, the not taking it right, the being on the wrong medication, you know, all of the different things that you have to consider when the medication isn't really doing its job. But and then the side effects, and for men, the side effects are not being able to have a normal sex life in many cases. So that in itself is why a lot of men don't want to take the medications. And I think Solomon goes into that in his book, in much more detail what it's like from a male standpoint to have to give up, you know, certain things. And so basically it's very it disrupts your life with medication and then certainly without medication, and so anything that might take 4 or 5 years to achieve would be virtually impossible.
Yes.
Unless you find the magic bullet, which is hard to do.
Yeah, that actually happens with me, Dr. Susan. I was doing, I was studying psychosynthesis, and 2 years into it, I had some real dips, and the stress of writing papers and
you just can't do it because you can't.
Yeah, I was traveling up to London a way, and I just found myself in a psychiatric hospital. But the people, the friends that I trained with were very, very supportive, and I was allowed to go back and continue the training, which was very good. Because not everybody has that possibility.
Yeah. Well, but there's some things that are particularly dangerous. You know, if you're in a dangerous, let's say you're fighting a war, and you're in danger, you put your, you're unable to do your job, so you automatically put your the people around you in danger. You know, these where you really have to be at your best to survive. You know, like there are certain circumstances where that happens. Or if you're an airline pilot, or if you're a surgeon, especially an airline pilot. Think about that.
Yes,
I mean,
there are quite a few. There are quite a few problems with airline pilots. I think, I don't know, it's probably the stress, but there are a few that...
Probably unrelenting stress, you know. You never know when it becomes very, very exciting, and you have to think very, very quickly. So, you know, it, and you're right, the men do tend to self-medicate with alcohol and drugs, and women more with Valium and, you know, pills. I see that in my population that truly have bipolar disorder.
But you can see by the amount of books that are coming out all the time on depression just how endemic it is, really.
I want to mention one interview I did to see if you've read his book. It's by a psychiatrist, Dr. I think it's Daniel Amen. He wrote a book on healing.
No, I haven't.
Oh, you've got to read it. The book I interviewed him on was Healing Anxiety and Depression. And it was so interesting what he did. He actually used the SpectroScan, which is a specialized type of brain scan, to differentiate 7 different kinds of anxiety and depression. And what he found was very interesting. He's really brilliant. And, you know, when I was interviewing him very early in an interview, he says, "Yes, I've been bleeding on the cutting edge for a while now," which is a great, a great statement. I love that.
Yes.
I just think he's great. But what he did was he distinguished 7 different kinds based on the scan, which separated people based on what part of the brain lit up. And in the teenage population, he found that the majority of them had temporal lobe disease.
Oh,
and that's why, and he said that when they take the SSRI inhibitors, it gets worse, and that's why they were seeing the suicides on it. So he was actually, he actually differentiated a form of depression that teenagers get more often, and then connected it with a complication, pretty severe complication, that unfortunately the manufacturers of the SSRI inhibitors found out about through trial and error rather than finding out about it before the drug was released. And so, you need to take a look at that because he, I'm sure bipolar falls in one of those categories, but, you know, but there is definitely a difference in he found 7 different kinds, and like he does also talk about homeopathics and supplements, you know, serotonin, like 5-HTP and stuff like that. So he is fairly holistic in that he doesn't just prescribe drugs. He, you know, if he says if something is going to work in the homeopathic and supplement realm, then you ought to use it rather than going on the drugs, which is, you know, good advice because they have a lot less side effects. But but you ought to take a look at it because you might really be able to, you know, help others determine what they have.
Fascinating, Dr. Susan. What's the surname?
I'm sorry, the book name?
The surname, Daniel...
Oh, Amen, A-M-E-N, like Amen.
Okay.
Amen. I don't know how he pronounces it.
He certainly is on the cutting edge.
He is, and he actually has clinics throughout the country. They started one here not too long ago. I was invited to go over and hear a lecture, and I actually was unable to find the address. It was really weird. I went over, and the address just wasn't there. Maybe they gave the wrong address. But in any case, I really think that it was a breakthrough in diagnosis anyway, you know. And
Crumbs,
then he has
really,
particular
it is,
treatments
it?
That work better for, you know, he would go through which treatments work the best for the different kinds. So that also... Well, you have to diagnose things correctly.
Yeah. And also, I think some sort of physical diseases can masquerade, like thyroid problems and lupus and tumor. Some of them can masquerade as depression. I was just thinking about a friend I have in Norway, and she was depressed for about 4 years, and she was in and out of hospital having various antidepressants, which really didn't work at all for her. And she was eventually diagnosed with Lyme disease. And she tells me that in some countries, they encourage their depressed clients to get tested for Lyme disease.
That's because Lyme's disease can manifest as neurological Lymes. We treat quite a bit of Lymes here. And, you know, think about it. You have things tend to slow down. You don't have energy. Your thoughts slow down. So I think that's why it's actually treated first as with SSRI inhibitors. And, of course, it fails miserably because SSRI inhibitors are not going to treat Lymes at all. And it's not depression, it's not serotonin, it's not neurotransmitters, but it is neurological because it's an intracellular infection. In fact, MS and ALS are also felt to be intracellular spirochetes and sometimes mycoplasma that can be treated successfully if you get them early enough. So a lot of neurodegenerative diseases are actually a form of intracellular infection. I interviewed Dr. Lydia Matman on the radio show a long time ago. It was probably in the 90s. And she's the author of Cell Wall Deficient Forms, a textbook on intracellular infections. And she told me that she had found the same intracellular spirochete in 30 MS patients, but the U.S. government gave her a court order not to tell any doctors. Basically, because it's the basis of our biological warfare system. So, and a lot more has come out. I've interviewed Dr. Garth Nicholson on multiple occasions. In fact, I think the interview before the last interview was on neurodegenerative diseases being caused by intracellular infection. His wife actually went to Hopkins with me, and she developed the test, the PCR test, that they use for mycoplasma and the polymerase chain reaction test to diagnose these intracellular infections. So, there's a very interesting book called Project A Lily that Garth wrote about his experiences and his wife's experiences having been bleeding on the cutting edge and being targets because of
Project
it.
Project A Lily. Was it?
Project A Lily, it's on Garth Nicholson's website. It's very revealing, and of course Garth knows Dr. Lydia Matman, and they've suffered similar, you know, problems because of the field they're in, really, the field they're in of investigation. Yeah. But in any case, it's a very interesting connection between these intracellular infections and the massive lack of research, the targeting of doctors that trying to take their medical license away that try to help patients with these diseases.
Oh, yeah.
And, just in general, our screwed up system where we put the national security issues way ahead of our own, populace.
At our detriment.
At our big detriment, because our populace is affected with these diseases, and they're a drain on the system. Both England and the U.S. have social security systems that we have to take care of these people with our tax dollars. And they're very infectious diseases. They get transmitted via animals and children, and so they end up affecting a lot of people. And there's no public information on it. The only public information is don't get bit by a tick. And tick bites are only one tiny part of what causes this disease to spread. And again, no education, So it reminds me of the Ebola thing, I'm sure you were wondering, if this thing isn't readily transmittable, how come all these doctors and nurses got it, who presumably knew how to protect themselves, Come on. It doesn't make any sense that...
And also the effects of pesticides on, the long-term effects of pesticides on us. There is a theory, I expect you're aware of it, because you're a hive of information there, it can cause pesticides can cause obesity. That it is behind a lot of obesity.
When you're toxic because you've been eating non-organic food, especially certain fruits and vegetables, and meats that have a lot of toxicity in them, your body puts on fat in order to dilute the toxin, because many of these toxins are hydrophobic. And that means the majority of the carcinogens and neurotoxins are hydrophobic. Methylethyl ketone, benzene, toluene, yes, they're hydrophobic. Mm-hmm. So the body puts on fat to dilute them and keep them away from other cells that are much more important, much more metabolically active, liver, kidney, brain, stomach, these things. So what we do here, and these are the hydrophobic chemicals that are so common in the silicone breast implants. So when the shell starts to leak, these chemicals get into the body. And like methylethyl ketone depletes arginine, which in turn depletes nitric oxide, so the patients get Raynaud's disease, where their extremities turn white and blue. Well, there's a cure for Raynaud's, and I've used it a lot of times. You do electrolysis hand bath, where you take the chemicals out through the hand bath, and it involves ozone in the water, and then you put them on a supplement that has a lot of arginine and things that make nitric oxide. And the one we're using right now is called Extreme NO. It's also good for heart disease. And the patients get over their Raynaud's, but... as I keep harping on the radio show, if you don't know the cause of something, you can't possibly determine the treatment.
No, you can't.
You can't. I mean,
I'm also
just treating the symptoms,
about,
and you're not treating the cause.
The gift of depression, the things that can emerge from depression, the creative arts and poetry.
Yeah.
And I wonder if I can read... a poem I wrote that came from my depression. Is that all right? It's called,
yes, please do.
Sometimes it is enough to stand without hope. The foundations beneath your feet have gone. That which you forged your truth from and fashioned your reality with has crumbled, and your tears cannot measure the emptiness you feel. Sometimes it is enough to admit your own powerlessness, enough to just be like the bulb in the deep earth. No one has asked you to believe that the sun will come again, and it doesn't matter. It will come anyway, despite you as well as for you. in your hopelessness and despair, when all has left you, even that which you loved, new foundations will form, that I promise you. Not ones set in transient things, but ones rooted deep in the eternal. Direction will come again. You will embrace the winds of heaven which eluded you before, and something stronger than hope will rise up out of yesterday's ashes. Something stronger than belief, even. It will be a knowing based on trust. That same trust which causes the eagle to dare the skies, or the frail snowdrop to bloom in the winter soil. Love will flower like a rose in the emptiness you felt nothing could fill, and heal your wounds with its fragrance. But until then, it is enough to stand without hope and honor your emptiness with dignity.
That's great. That's beautiful.
It's something that emerged from depression and quite a lot of poetry is written
And music,
through depression.
Right.
And
it is, yeah.
I wanted to share that.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I also, while you were reading that, it came to me, I treat quite a bit of cancer here, and it occurs to me that a strategy that we use in the treatment of advanced cancer can be used in depression as well. And that is the thought, which I would encourage, if you find yourself in depression, to be given guidance on how to get out of it. And pay attention to synchronicities, pay attention to, you know, if you start seeing your attention, your consciousness being drawn to, you know, commercials on either in the magazines or on TV on antidepressants, that could be your guides and your angels pointing in that direction.
Yeah.
Your friends mentioning doctors. You know, we don't have to do everything ourselves.
No.
Spirit allows other people to come in to help us, and we just have to pay attention to what's right in front of us. Some people get over cancer by taking chemotherapy, and that is right for them. But other people, if they're going to take chemotherapy, are going to die from the chemotherapy because it destroys their immune system, and that's what's going to get them out of cancer. So I'm not, just like with cancer, I don't have preferences on treatment programs. Some patients with depression need antidepressants, but like if you're a teenager, you don't need an SSRI inhibitor that's going to increase your risk of suicide. So you might need something else, you know, some other drug, because there are other drugs other than SSRI inhibitors. But the point is, when you're in danger, and you are in danger from depression and from cancer, if you pray, you need to ask for help.
Yeah.
And so many people don't realize this. Ask for help, and then your angels and your guides and your support, your spiritual support system, will get you things that you need, and all you have to do is recognize it when it comes into your, you know, your field of vision.
Yeah, that's
and,
so
and
true.
And I'm sure that will work. I'm sure that will work for severe depression.
Yeah, it
does
work.
To get the help you need.
Yeah, I do believe that. Certainly, help has come to me in ways that, you know, like through this figure that I saw at the end of my bed, and, you know, in ways that I didn't expect. And it's not, you know, the sort of concrete mind will sort of demote it and say it's not important, but it's listening to that other part of your mind that is linked to the higher consciousness.
Right.
That's the important thing.
Yeah. And I do believe that in at the soul level, we know that at the soul level, you do choose your parents, which means you choose your genetics.
Yeah,
and that the people who are experiencing bipolar disease, there is a higher spiritual purpose for it because you are choosing it when, you know, at a level outside of space and time.
And we don't know the where that's going to take us. I mean, some of the best therapists that I know are people that have struggled a lot within themselves.
Right, exactly. So, because they have compassion. You develop compassion once you have the disease,
And empathy, and which is very important, empathy
it
and
is.
Resilience.
Absolutely. Well, we're coming up at the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Do you mean the web?
Okay.
It's just Stephanie Sorrell. That's all one word, Stephanie Sorrell. And it's
S-O-R-R-E-L-L.
Yeah, and it's .com, and that's the web address.
Okay.
And the email address is Steffi, S-T-E-F-F-I-E, Sorrell, S-O-R-R-E-L-L, @gmail.com.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a delightful discussion, and I would encourage anybody who has experienced depression or is touched by it with friends or family members to read your book. It's a very good book.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you and sharing with you, Dr. Susan. You're very talented.
Well, thank you. Well, we've been interviewing Stephanie Sorrell. Her book, Depression, Understanding the Black Dog, is one of the best I've seen on spirituality and depression, and will help those whose lives are touched by this disease. Next week, we have Tom Palladio back on, discussion of scalar energy. And I'm going to ask Tom if he has depression cases. Scalar energy is energy that's coming in from the fifth dimension, and it's probably involved in spontaneous remission and also incorruptibility. That's where corpses don't decay. So it might really help depression. And then on the 25th, we are interviewing Dhanan Chante on accessing the many levels of guidance we all have available to us at all times, which would be a good book for anybody to read who has life challenges. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show.